RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for another RCR Health Hacks Monday morning, and back with us to talk about the A to Z of fasting. Now, remember last Monday, I think we got up to the letter M. That's as far as we got, so we're going to pick up the rest of the alphabet, the A to Z of fasting, with Dr. Glenn Davies. Morning, Glenn. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you, Paul. Thriving.
So well, that's good. That's good. All right. So do you want to recap on where we left off last week? Okay, we got to L, but you might want to just recap a bit before we sort of carry on with the alphabet.
So let's do that. So fasting is an incredibly powerful tool for your metabolic health. It's certainly something that everyone should be considering if they have a metabolic challenge. So we're talking about, you know, type 2 diabetes or being overweight or any of these chronic health conditions. It can definitely have a part. I'm going to whiz just through the A to M very quickly as a bit of a review. Then we'll slow down and do the rest of the alphabet. And then at the end, we'll do a little bit of a practical talk about what fasting actually looks like. So the big thing that happens when you're fasting is it's an opportunity for us to replace and recycle worn out cells or worn out cell components, and that's called autophagy and apoptosis. The big point is that happens in the period of time when you're not eating, and it happens less or doesn't occur when you are fed. So most of us aren't giving enough time for these important processes of removing damaged cells to occur. So that's part of the idea behind fasting. So that's autophagy and apoptosis. We talked about the brain using about 25% of the body's energy, and it can use either glucose or ketones. And that's part of the argument of using using fasting, give the brain a different fuel source.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about what we've been doing for the last 70 years is telling people to eat less and move more, and it clearly hasn't been working. And that's because when you restrict calories, you slow your metabolic rate. However, when you fast or miss meals, you actually increase your metabolic rate. You know, so that's one of the clear and really important differences between calorie restriction and fasting. Energy balance, and we mentioned the world's longest fast at 382 days,
yes,
so
that's
over
right.
a year. Yeah. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because that just fascinates me. It absolutely, completely fascinates me, so we'll talk a bit more about that. We want to become a fat-burning machine. We want to be able to burn stored fat rather than storing it. And that's one of the important things that can happen when you fast. And we talked about this concept of mismatched genes. So we still have caveman genes, but the modern food environment has changed dramatically. So we have this mismatch between what our genes are instructing our body to do and what the food environment is creating. And if we need to largely go back to eating the patterns and the foods that our ancestors were eating, and I would almost guarantee, I have no way of proving this, but I'd almost guarantee that our caveman ancestors were not eating six meals a day. I think they were possibly eating once a day, you know, and that's part of what we're trying to do is match our modern and food environment with our genes again.
And there was no driving down to the takeout for a Brontosaurus burger or
yeah,
a rib.
Yeah, that's
or
right. And,
the car
you
over.
Make a really a good point. You're actually sitting in your car as they hand you your food. Very, very different to having to chase a gazelle for 21 kilometres in the midday heat in order to have something to eat. You know, our food and energy expenditure environment has changed so dramatically.
And hormesis?
Yeah, hormesis. This is this idea of putting your body under short, sharp stresses and you becoming more resilient or less fragile as a consequence. And fasting is an example of hormesis. It's a stress which is good for your body. It's different from the chronic stress that we're all so concerned about. These short, sharp stresses, like missing a meal, is actually good for you. And the other part of H is hungry. It's not the end of the world if you're a little bit hungry. You know, nobody has died from being hungry for a few hours. You know, it's not something to be afraid of, and it's actually something we should cherish, because there's a whole lot of metabolic magic happening when we're hungry.
I remember doing a almost four-day fast, right? Not eating, well, normal food, drunk water, obviously, through that time. And I noticed the first day and a half, you had extreme hunger pains, let's say, building up after about that. And you went through about 2.5 days, and then I noticed that hunger feeling came right off. And you sort of got to a way of thinking or feeling where you kind of feel like you go on quite a long time like this. You know, you sort of broke through. That's what I found. I did nearly 4 days of not eating just to see what it was like. And that's one thing I do remember.
Yeah, and that's almost a universal statement that the first 24 to 36 hours you experience hunger, and then after that time you're far less likely to. So, yep, absolutely true. And then the immune system, we know that insulin is released when we eat. And we know that when we fast, we produce ketones. That balance between the insulin causing an inflammatory or immune response and the ketones dampening it down is part of that yin and yang approach that happens with eating and fasting. And L, low carb diets or ketogenic diets, these are fast mimicking diets. And I think the idea is that you can get many of the benefits of fasting without having to be hungry. So that's really the advantage of these low-carb, healthy fat diets or ketogenic diets, which so much go along with fasting. And then we got to M, and we talked about this idea that you can slow your metabolic rate by up to 300 calories per day if you calorie restrict. But that doesn't happen when you are fasting. And then we got up to N. So N is, oh, thank you, Vanessa. Paul, I don't think you've, this is my wife, Vanessa. You've never met her, I don't think. But
oh, hello
Paul,
there.
Paul Brennan.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, nice to meet you. You're actually real.
Yeah, I do exist.
Oh, that's fantastic. Really great to meet you. Yeah, fantastic.
She's just bringing me coffee.
Oh, that's nice. I had to make my own, but never mind.
See you later.
Okay, nice to meet you. All the best. We'll snip that little bit. That's okay. Unless right. You want it in there.
Sorry about that. And now,
that's all right. Yeah.
N is for nutrition or nutritional science. And the big point here is that I don't think we've learnt everything yet about fasting. I think as the science develops, we will find more and more benefits. I think it's something like a book, and we've only written the first three chapters. I think fasting is going to become a much more important tool in a doctor's armory as we go forth. So,
right, yeah,
watch the space.
Yeah, the big difference between now and all those pointers and back in, when I say the day, thousands of years ago, is that we all comfortably know the kind of we're going to be fed again. But back then, no one knew when the next meal would be. They probably thought that there would be one, but they didn't know when it would be exactly and what sort of effort or calorie burn or whatever you want to, however you want to put it, would have to go into getting that food.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it? And there's a really important point you're making there. The difference between starvation and fasting. Fasting is a choice, and you know that at any time you could stop, whereas starvation is not a choice, and there's a lot of fear and stress associated with starvation, whereas fasting is very similar to what you described earlier. You were doing it to challenge yourself, you were doing it to find out what it felt like, but you knew at any time that you could stop. And I think that's the psychological difference between fasting and starvation. And you know, it must have been back in the day, the caveman day, there must have been a lot of stress around the idea of where will the next meal come from.
Yeah, it must have been pretty well dominated, everything, by that.
Yeah, but when you think about it, it was basically all that you had to do. All you had to do was find food and shelter. And if there was some energy left over, you probably sat around a fire and told some stories. But they weren't trying to cram into their day as much as we're trying to cram in. You know, it was only food and shelter, I expect, and maybe a little bit of occasional reproduction.
Occasional. So they get up in the morning, it's like, what should we do today? Or what do you think? Are you hungry? Yeah, okay. Same as yesterday. Yeah, that'd be about it. And if we have any time left over, we might tell some stories or something. But it just would have been so dominated with having to find, well, in the end, energy, right? Energy.
Yep, definitely.
Okay.
There's no Q. So we're up to R. And this really important topic of insulin resistance. And it's said that up to 87% of American adults have insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is a very abnormal state. And it's what's behind all of these metabolic health conditions that I talk about repeatedly, the type 2 diabetes, the being overweight, and to some extent cancer, and to some extent Alzheimer's disease. All of these chronic health conditions have insulin resistance at their core, and it comes from eating too often and eating the wrong foods. It comes from eating 6 meals a day or 3 meals a day, and it comes from eating these ultra-processed foods that are laden with sugar, and that's what's causing insulin resistance. And we need to move back to more of that caveman lifestyle where we're eating less often. And the food that we're eating has recently been growing, swimming, flying, or walking. You know, and it was fresh and it was seasonal. You know, everything the caveman ate was in season because they didn't have any method of storing food. Maybe later on, you know, I think curing food with salt and then smoking food and drying it became a feature later on, but early on, I don't think they had those technologies, if that's the right word.
I've been doing a little bit of observation quietly in the background, little superette that I go to, and it's usually pretty busy, and people are buying. It's a mix between one of the, you know, automatic machines or the checkout, and I'm curious, especially around lunchtime. And I'm noticing a lot of people, and because, see, I know more about this now. Thank you, Glenn. So I've got a more critical eye on things. I've noticed that a lot of people will buy something like a pie and a V energy drink for lunch. Yeah. And I'm thinking, crikey, I don't think that's so good. And I can tell that there's no understanding of what you're putting in your body. I think it's quite a common thing. People just assume that it's, well, maybe they don't even think about it, or it's kind of okay. So I noticed, and I wasn't being nosy, but I'm curious because I know more now after talking with you, that that's quite a common, well, that's around lunchtime for quite a few people. And I'm thinking, no. But no one's giving much of a thought to it. That's what people are having for lunch quite a bit, actually, from my observation. So basically energy drinks and pies.
Yeah. When you mention energy drinks and pies, isn't that so dramatically different from what our caveman ancestors would have had access
to? Totally. That's what I stand there thinking. You see, I almost feel like saying, do you know that? But I don't, of course.
And there is so much sugar in one of those energy drinks. I can't remember the exact amount, but huge amounts. And interestingly, with drinks, the caveman only had access to water. You know, that was it. And our insulin response only understands water, which has no glucose in it. And the body gets really confused when it has a drink with sugar in it. It's completely confusing to our caveman genes. And I think that's one of the really big contributors to insulin resistance is the sugary drinks. So And the other thing is, a lot of people say to me, but I only have one teaspoon of sugar in my coffee, or I only have one teaspoon of sugar in my tea. You should only have one teaspoon of sugar in your whole blood, you know, whole 5 liters of blood at any one time. So that one teaspoon is actually a lot of sugar. It's doubling the amount of sugar in your blood. You know, it's not an insignificant thing to be doing. And to have the energy drink, which is something like, I don't know, 8 teaspoons or more, that's a massive insult to your body. And it takes a lot of manipulation, metabolic manipulation, to manage that huge hit of sugar that the body's completely unprepared for.
Is that like an OD on sugar?
Yeah, it's almost. I would consider it more of a stress, you know, it's, The body's not prepared for it. Like, you start producing insulin when you start thinking about food and when you smell food and when you're preparing it. Whereas when you take a drink of a sugary drink, the body is anticipating water and it gets this hit of sugar and it's not prepared. It's not ready to receive it, and it causes havoc.
Yeah. Are we done with insulin resistance? That's R for insulin resistance, by the way.
Yeah, I just did want to say that it can be harder at certain times of your life. And, particularly women tend to be more insulin resistant, but particularly at puberty and in that perimenopausal time, and particularly in pregnancy as well, as because you would have heard of the term gestational diabetes. People haven't changed necessarily what they're eating, but their level of insulin resistance has changed. So it can be harder at certain times in your life.
Right. Okay. S is for what?
S is for stress, and this comes back to the concept of hormesis, and small, sharp stresses like turning your shower on to cold or missing a meal, that is good for you. That's consistent with what our genes are used to, but chronic stress of work overload or overwhelm or chronic poor sleep, that's chronic stress in the body. That is not good for the body. So we want adaptive stress, not chronic stress.
So we can take the little sort of like short-term peaks and troughs.
Yeah, and it makes us stronger. The analogy is when you go to the gym, you break down muscle with doing your biceps curls, but when the muscle grows back, it's better adapted, it's stronger than it was. That's the impact of these short, sharp stresses.
Right.
But these prolonged stresses just wear the body down and cause harm. So there's a distinct difference.
All right. That's S.
T. T stands for the time of the day. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to talk about time-restricted eating, but we are less likely to be hungry in the morning and we are more likely to be hungry at night. So if we're going to miss a meal, the easiest one to miss is breakfast. And most people can miss breakfast and make it through to brunch or morning smoko, or make it through to lunch. And that's strongly what I would advocate. If you can make it through to lunchtime to have your first meal and eat 2 meals a day, you're going to be getting all the benefits without too much hardship. Most people can sustain that small amount of hunger until lunchtime. And like you were talking about with your 4-day fast, you adapt to it and it becomes normal and the hunger pains go away once you've adapted.
They do. Yeah. I'm just wondering, though, are people actually hungry when they wake up, or have people been educated into thinking, because I remember being told that breakfast was one of the most important meals of the day, this is going back ages, and that you had to sort of like replenish yourself as soon as you kind of woke up. I don't go near food now till about midday, actually.
Fantastic. And, you know, that's called intermittent fasting, and that's absolutely ideal. Yeah. And you bring up an important point. I think there's two aspects to hunger. There's actually the physiological feeling of the hunger prangs, but then there's the emotional part of hunger, which is I'm bored or I'm lonely or food will provide me with comfort or I need a reward. you know, I've just written that report.
I just woke up, just made it through the night. Yeah.
You know, well, I've just spent 2 hours writing that really difficult report. I'm going to reward myself with a coffee and a ginger nut. Is food really something that we reward ourselves with, or should it be sustenance and fuel?
Well, it definitely has a comfort dimension to it, I think, for a lot of people.
It does. It does. And I think one of the things we do with our health coaching is we ask people to clearly identify what the emotion is, because a lot of things that we call hunger are actually other emotions. So they might be loneliness, they might be tiredness. You know that with young kids, eh? You know, you kind of go, are they tired or are they hungry? You know, that happens to adults as well. Sometimes we're just tired. Sometimes we're just frustrated. Sometimes we're just overwhelmed. I don't know, but it's not always hungry. Sometimes we're just thirsty, you know, so just having sometimes
fill us up.
Desire. So that's time of day.
All right. You.
Now, this is interesting. So this is under control. And one of the arguments against fasting is people say if you fast for 24 hours, you'll just eat twice as much the next day. And therefore, you've over that 48 hours, you've achieved no net benefit. That's not supported by the science. The science says that if people fast for 24 hours, they may eat up to 20% more the next day, but they're certainly not doubling their food intake.
No,
so there is a net benefit. So
I agree with that. Yep.
Under control.
All right. V.
V is for vegetables. Now, this is really interesting. So this is talking about the mountain gorilla, which is a completely vegetarian, vegan animal. And if you look at the macronutrients of the food it takes in, only 2.5% of its diet is fat, 24.3% is protein, and 15% is available carbohydrate. The remaining 57% is fiber. So over half of the diet of the gorilla is fiber. But what happens to that fiber is that the microbiome of the gorilla, and you'll notice that gorillas have that big tummy.
Yep.
A lot of fermentation happening in there. And the vast majority of that fiber is turned into short-chain fatty acids. It's converted into fat by the organisms that live in the gut. And effectively, the gorilla is on a high-fat diet if you look at what's available to the cells.
Gee, incredible.
So even though only 2.5% of it is fat at the mouth, you know, once it's absorbed, 57% of it is fat. So this process of turning fiber into short-chain fatty acids is important. And I think in adults, that's up to 15% of the available fat is from this microbiome fermentation process. So it's important that we look after our microbiome. That's a whole another topic, but fasting is supportive of the microbiome. So that's the reason that this topic is in here.
Okay.
You know, eating the vegetables, supporting our microbiome, and making sure that we're making these short-chain fatty acids is important.
All right.
B, you're about to say what comes after V there, Paul, I think, weren't you? W.
No, I was wondering how long we've got. The Warburg effect, I believe, is
yeah.
What is that?
The 1930s, Otto Warburg discovered that cancer cells predominantly use glucose as their fuel source.
Yes, I know that. Yeah.
And this is the argument for fasting and for ketogenic diets in cancer, because you're going to reduce the available glucose to an absolute minimum. You're going to potentially starve the cancer cells.
Yep.
And what's more, when you fast during cancer treatments, you're turning off those growth hormones, like growth hormone itself, another one called mTOR and insulin. And it also protects the normal cells against the collateral damage from radiotherapy and chemotherapy. So there's a lot of argument for using fasting in an intelligent way during cancer treatment.
Could you fast your way out of, well, I mean, that's probably a bit of a strong question, but, you know, to go on an ultra fast while you've got cancer, can you literally starve the cancer cells? Is that what it's doing?
Yeah, and in the community I live in Taupo, there's a woman, Sirona Ramaka, and she's done exactly that. She has used a ketogenic diet and fasting and has turned around an advanced cancer of the thymus. So
wow.
It's
okay.
Reduced to about 4% of its original size.
4%? That's huge.
Yeah, and that may just be remaining scar tissue. And that was 6 years ago. She was was given weeks to live, and that was 6 years ago. And her treatment was a ketogenic diet and fasting. So, yes, absolutely, there are examples of people that have only used that as a treatment and have reversed their cancer.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty cool. All right, any more on – okay, we're at 2X now. Yep.
Yeah. So let's just talk a little bit more about this longest fast in the world. So this happened in, this was 382 days, so over a year. And what happened was patient AB, he turned up in Scotland to a Scottish hospital and he talked to Dr. Fleming and Dr. Stewart. This was in 1973.
Okay.
Dr. Stewart, Dr. Fleming, I'm a fat bastard. And I want you to keep me here in your hospital until I'm skinny. And that's exactly what they did. They kept him in hospital for 382 days. And over that time, he lost 125 kilograms.
Gosh.
He went down to 82 kg over that time. He passed a bowel motion every 42 days, which is fascinating in itself. Some people say to me, but there was no food, no food at all. Why do you pass bowel motions at all? The answer is that bulk is coming from the cells which slough off the intestinal lining. So once every 42 days, if you eat nothing and just have vitamins and water, that's about how often you'd expect to pass a bowel motion. So he wasn't constipated. There was just nothing to come out.
Right. 42 days. Boy. All right, and the guy was fine at the end of the process, right?
Yeah, and what was really fascinating, perhaps the most fascinating part about this story, is they reviewed him at 5 years after discharge, and his weight had only gone up to 89 kg, so he had gained 7 kilograms over that 5 years, which is dramatically different from most diets and even from weight loss surgery. People often regain at 2 years, most of the weight. With fasting, he didn't, and I think the reason is that he didn't slow his metabolic rate in the same way as you do when you calorie restrict.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I got it.
With the surgery. So it's an absolute argument for including fasting in a weight loss regime.
All right, almost up against time. We're not quite at the end of the alphabet. In fact, we're just jumping right to the end of it now with Z.
We're just
for-
at Z.
And sleep doesn't begin with Z, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, and it's just really to say that, you know, there's a whole lot more to it than just what we eat or what we don't eat. We've got to think of our stress levels and, you know, regular sleep and drinking enough water and our relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the A to Z. But if I've got a little bit more time, Paul, just wanted to talk about of the specific regime. So the first one is called time-restricted eating. And what that means is you still have 3 meals a day, but you have your first meal a little bit later and you have your last meal a little bit earlier. So you're condensing the feeding window and consequently extending the fasting window. And remember, all the magic occurs in the time that you're not eating. So that's time-restricted eating, and that's usually an easy way to start. And then often people move then into intermittent fasting, which means you drop that first meal. So you move from the time-restricted eating into intermittent fasting, and you start eating two meals a day, with that first meal at lunchtime and your last meal, say, at 6 o'clock at night. So that's intermittent fasting, two meals a day. And then people sometimes will move into one meal a day, which is called OMAD, and just have that evening meal. And that's often referred to as 23-1. So 1 hour of eating and 23 hours of fasting. So that's intermittent fasting. And then you get into the longer fasts. It's a little bit hard to say what is the long fasting and what is sort of usual fasting, but something up to 48 hours, 2 days, is probably fairly easy for most people to do without any extra knowledge or supervision. But you do have to increase your water and you do have to increase your salt intake.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Once you're going for fasting, probably beyond that 72 hours, I think you have to have some specific knowledge and probably have done a bit of research or work with a coach or work with someone who has experience, because you know there are some things to think about once you get into that longer fasting. You probably add in some vitamins as well. Some people might use bone broth during those long fasts as well. So that is the A to Z of fasting. And just want to finish off by saying there are some people or situations where you wouldn't fast. So it's not appropriate for children. It's not appropriate for pregnancy or breastfeeding. And it may not be appropriate for the very elderly. And also anyone that's had an eating disorder or an abnormal relationship with food, they also probably would have to give some extra thought to whether fasting is appropriate for them.
All right, that's been really useful, both today and last Monday, because we've now been from the A to Z of fasting. Very empowering information, brilliantly delivered, Glenn. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Paul. And thank you for having me again.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.